Hello and welcome to Learn With Us. Today I'm with Tracy Orsborne, who is the Programme Manager of Tiny Seed. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Yes, good. Just started a new work with a new client in London. Quite exciting work. Just got back from travelling around Europe and for Christmas. Yeah. How was your Christmas?
Awesome. It was great. It was pretty quiet because I came back to my house in Toronto. I bought a house recently, so I've been spending my time, well, I'm not on a computer, I'm spending my time painting walls and painting trim and taking down walls and doing all sorts of house improvement stuff. So today was officially like my first real full-time day back at work, and it was kind of a nice to get back to work on Tiny Seed after doing this house stuff for a while because it got a little exhausting. So it was like it was a good relaxing holiday, but I'm also happy to get back to work now.
So you're also quite active in open source, it seems.
Yeah, in a way. I'm in the orbit of some of the big open sourcers. My husband, Andre, is the author of the original author of Urlib3, which is one of the largest open source Python packages. So it's used in things like requests. But just by being in his orbit meant that I'm exposed to a lot of the open source world. I'm encouraged to do a lot of stuff in that world. So while I don't particularly work in it myself, I have been able to network a lot with the people in that area and be a part of that ecosystem.
Okay, and you've also you've finished up with a company there to do with weddings, I see.
Yeah, like rounding up about 10 years ago, I decided that I was living in California at the time. I'm in Toronto, Canada now, but at the time I was living in California in Silicon Valley, and it seemed like everyone I knew was starting companies. So I decided to teach myself how to program. I launched a company called Wedding Lovely, and kind of had this crazy roller coaster of a startup time in the time, you know, in those last 10 or so years. I launched the company to a lot of fanfare. I got into the 500 startup accelerator, raised some money with them. But then there was like some the things that didn't go so well. The company kind of fizzled out for a little bit. I kind of moved it to bootstrapping. Then I raised a little more money, but that didn't really go as well as well. I ended up hiring some people to run the company, and then it started doing really well until Google decided to change some of those algorithms. And that was the time where I finally looked back at the entire process of running this company and decided that I learned a lot from doing that, doing everything. And it's really hard to shut something down that you've been working on for so long. I used this like Google algorithm update to really like look critically on what I had built and made the decision that was the time to finally move on, which it was like a blessing in disguise because I didn't, you know, one of the kind of things about working on something like that for so long was that I probably have missed a lot of opportunities for things that are potentially bigger and better than what I was working on at Wedding Lovely just because I was heads down on that company. So now I'm working at Tiny Seed, which is a startup accelerator for bootstrappers. It's my forever job. I love it so much. I'm very happy I shut down Wedding Lovely at the time to allow me to move on to Tiny Seed because I don't know. I would have missed this opportunity if I didn't do that. So it's kind of a fun learning process from running that company and from shutting down that company, which has led to what I'm working on now.
And you're also an author, I see, writing and making video, producing videos for web development teaching.
Yeah. When I started getting burnt out on Wedding Lovely, this was 6 or so years into it. I needed something else to work on just to keep myself engaged and excited about what I was doing on the computer. So I had taught myself how to code with Wedding Lovely. And in the process of teaching myself how to code, I would figure things out and would look back on the ways I taught myself, like the tutorials I used and the resources I used. And after a certain point, I realized that I wish there was like a different way those resources were structured, or if there was a different way those tutorials were run. And it kind of led to the idea that once I got strong enough in my own coding journey, that maybe it would be worth it for me to write the guide that I wish existed that would be for the kind of person I was. So I was, my background's in design. I have a graphic design degree and I've been building websites on and off for a long time, but there wasn't a lot of programming tutorials were kind of assuming you had background in other programming languages. So I would talk about things like views and models and all that kind of stuff. But to someone from like me who just like would build HTML websites, like very, like mostly CSS, some JavaScript background. All those terms didn't really make sense to me. So I decided to kickstart a programming tutorial using Django, which is a framework for the Python web framework, Python programming language, how to build a web app with Django, from like creating an idea to launching on Heroku. And I did a lot of, I'm still really proud of what I did there. It's a little out of date right now just because Django keeps updating. I have to go through and re-update the tutorial again. But there's some things that I think I did that were really awesome. Like the contents, you're building what I call as a collection of things. And there's things like a blog is a collection of posts, or like an Instagram clone is a collection of images. So this tutorial being very generic, I encourage people to go through the tutorial and build something that's unique to them. And I find that when people are building something for the first time or learning programming, when you go through tutorials verbatim, it doesn't really stick. But when you go through and you are building something that is unique to yourself and kind of gets those creative juices flowing, it means that what you're learning is far more likely to stick. It's far more likely to encourage you to continue building the app afterwards, to continue your programming journey. So that was one of the biggest value adds I did with Hello Web App. And since launching that, I did a Kickstarter for a second book that's now bundled in with the first book. And I've also written a third book called Hello Web Design, which kind of takes the other side of the coin, which teaches web design concepts for programmers, whereas like Hello Web App is programming concepts for designers. So it's been really fun. These are all under the Hello Web Books brand, hellowebbooks.com. I'm still running them kind of very part-time now that I'm super busy with Tiny Seed. But it was like probably one of my most fulfilling, best side projects, side hustles, what you might call it, that I've ever done. And it was just, it's been really awesome to take those books and use them to speak at conferences and meets. I've probably had like over 3,000 or 4,000 readers so far. So it's been a really, really fun project.
Yes, a well-produced website. It looks like a nice book for people to get started with web development.
Yeah. It was also a really fun website to build. I used a couple of frameworks for that before. So I used to sell on Gumroad, and I did all my videos on Podia. And it's fun. It's a great like way to bootstrap a project like this, because it's already a lot of work to build a book. But for me, it's just the joy of building and working with web apps. And that's the reason why I wrote Hello Web App. So I architected the Hello Web Books website myself. It has this whole CMS aspect. I have a whole backend. Everything's now hosted on Hello Web Books, the videos and everything. So it was kind of just a really fun labor of love for me to build that and get everything under one roof. Even though I would say it's not 100% monetarily successful. I've made a lot of money over the years from Hello Web Books. I'm very happy with it. It's not bringing a lot of money right now, mainly because I don't have a lot of time to spend on marketing or sales. But building the website was just a fun little side project for me, even though it's not going to pay out in revenue. Sometimes it's just fun to get lost in building a web app system.
Do you find that you have a larger proportion of female readers because you're female, of course?
That's a good question. I actually don't know the demographics of my readers, but based on the people that come up to me at conferences, I would say that's probably a 50-50 split. This is all using just gut feelings and guessing. I have no idea. That said, that was one of my original criticisms of programming tutorials. As I find, these are all very generic words I'm going to say just now, and I don't mean to apply this to an entire ecosystem of demographics. But I find that women tend to be more visually oriented learners. And I wrote Hello Web App so that you see everything in the browser as you're building, as compared to seeing your results in a command line. And I find that like leaning towards the visuals, seeing what's going on, seeing a website in the process of being built, does help people who are more visually oriented to understand what's going on and to feel like they're being successful as they're building their web app, as compared to say, running an algorithm in your command line, you run the script and it just pops out with a word saying it worked, but you don't really, if you're more visual oriented, like I am, doesn't really feel like success when you just see something pop up in the command line, at least when you're beginning, when you're bringing your programming journey. So I would say that I wrote it in a way that I feel would fit better with other communities other than the ones that typically go into programming. And I did that as I am also a woman myself. But I also find a lot of guys are also visual learners as well. And it's worked out for them as at least the feedback I've gotten so far.
Yeah, I think it's easy to teach people if they can see instant results.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're trying to set up your first view and you just want to like get a page up, I just, you know, someone who just wants to build something on the web to have other people see on the web, it's important to see the results as you build also on the web, you know. But a lot of like the original Django tutorial, which I think was a polling app, there really wasn't like anything that talks about templates or the front end of the app until like part four or something like that of the 4-part series. And so that was one of the first things I looked at that told me, I was like, okay, there was a need in the, at least in this ecosystem, the Django ecosystem, for something that's a little more visually oriented.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on to Tiny Seed. For me, Tiny Seed is quite interesting because I haven't experienced much experience with investment companies, but I quite like the terms of like they only take like 10 or 12% of equity, plus they give you like an upfront salary or something like that. I'm probably not explaining
that
well.
No worries. I can do a little bit of an overview. So right now, you know, when someone has they're starting their own company, traditionally there's only been two paths for someone to take. So they can either bootstrap their company, meaning that they don't raise any money, they don't take any outside investment. They self-fund their company and they self-fund it through the life cycle of the company, keeping 100%, owning 100% of the company. But really it's a lot of risk. You don't have a lot of, it's like a slower growth because you don't have a lot of, money to play with, money to spend on hiring or spend on sales. And then traditionally the other path was to raise venture capital. And in that path, which I did with Wedding Lovely, when you raise money from investors, you're pushed into a higher trajectory, a higher expected trajectory. You have money that you can use to hire salespeople and marketers and developers and potentially increase the growth rate of your company by a ton, but the investors want to see a return from their business. They want to see that you're pushing aggressively into other areas. And sometimes they can push you into being too aggressive and kind of building an unsustainable company. So a lot of VCs will say like, you know, 1 out of 10 companies that they fund is going to be success and 9 were failures. And so when you're starting a venture-backed company, it's like people are already looking at you. It's like either go big or go home, really. So Tiny Seed is trying to create a middle option. Tiny Seed works with bootstrappers, people who didn't raise money, but gives them just enough money and just enough like a boost to help them get to, say, the next level, just enough money to either go full time or hire their first person. And so that's the investment side of things. Give them just the money to do that effort, but still continue to build their company as they wish. They don't have to go into that VC roller coaster track. And it's also a accelerated program. So it's a year-long program that includes mentorship with a lot of really awesome founders out there like Rand Fishkin and Laura Roeder of Meet Edgar. So you get mentorship, you get this year-long program, you get weekly calls with the Tennessee team, myself, Rob, and Einar. The community of everyone that batched together, kind of like how Y Combinator or 500 Startups would do things. But a longer program as we're a year long rather than 3 months. And the way our docs are structured is that instead of we take a piece of equity, as you mentioned, and we don't give salary, but there is a salary cap. And that just ties into how Tiny Seed eventually gets paid back, is that the founders can continue to take their profits and reinvest into their company, but they have a cap on their salary. And if there's any moment where the founders say, hey, I have enough money for the company and I want to pay myself more, they can issue dividends and Tiny Seed will get a portion of those dividends. So kind of aligns the interests of the founders and Honeyseed, allows us to invest in a group of companies that previously weren't being invested in, these bootstrap companies, and also just work with some really amazing founders and help them, say, get to that next level. So it's been an incredibly fulfilling job to be working on right now.
What's a bootstrap company again?
A bootstrap company is a company that doesn't take outside investment. So you're growing your company entirely under your own means. Right, so you're using you could be using your own money for hiring or paying yourself, for growing a salary and just reinvesting the revenues your business is making into the business, but not talking or working with investors.
But aren't you guys investors?
So we're kind of creating a new term. So we say we're investments for bootstrapped companies because we don't require you to raise money afterwards. But there isn't really a term that explains, like, oh, we take just enough money. So we've been calling it indie funding now. Right. So indie companies but that's a part where we're still working on the branding for it. But we're trying to go for people who are interested in owning, like, who have that bootstrapping ethos and have been previously bootstrapped, and just giving them another option other than raising a full round of money.
Mm-hmm. So is it North America right now you're working with?
We work with U.S. companies in terms of company structure. So if your company is registered in the U.S. as an LLC or a C Corp, that said, the founders can be anywhere. We have two people in our current batch that are not in the U.S., actually three companies that are not in the U.S. And they just have their companies registered in the U.S. So we have that company registry requirement just because of the legality of the investment side of things. We can work with any U.S. state. So if you have like a California LLC or a C Corp in Delaware or anything like that, we can work with all 50 U.S. states. But the docs, we don't have the ability yet to invest in companies, say, registered in France or elsewhere.
So that
just means we just have people use Stripe Atlas and they just reincorporate in the U.S. to work with us.
So is Ohio quite a popular option with outside investors? Ohio with outside founders.
Oh, I actually don't know.
Because there's like, they've got this thing in Ohio now, I think it's just like, there's some states in America that are really easy to register limited company, LLCs. I was looking at it a while back when I first started talking to you guys.
Yeah, I didn't know about Ohio. Usually people tend to register in Delaware. That seems to be like the default. But all the states have their own different requirements. I mean, I say as a California native, I love California, but there's some things like California. If you registered your company there, you're subject to an $800 a year. I don't know if you call it a tax or just a fee. I don't know what it's called, but there's things like that where it depends on the state you're in. You might be subject to more fees or more things that come out of your business, which is why a lot of people try to register or have their company based in a state other than California. So that's something that I've learned. I learned with myself through Wedding Lovely. And just one of those kind of things to keep in mind when someone's registering in the US.
So what kind of requirements are you looking for like, I guess the founders must have like an MVP or something like that, that refusers?
Yeah. Yeah, we're going through... What I was doing right before this call is I was on a call with Rob and Anar trying to figure out who was going to be on our second batch, because we just finished our application process. Applications closed at the end of November, and the three of us have been discussing and then trying to have a proper holiday since December 1st. So we're trying to figure out who's going to be in the batch two by the end of this month, which is January. And we had a lot of really amazing applications come in. So some of the things we look for in application is we do want to see an MVP. It's really, we are not in the space, unfortunately, to fund ideas. So we want to see an MVP, want to see some revenue, want to see some kind of proof of market to show that you're in a space and you have the ability to show that people want your product, people are paying for your product. So that's like the biggest thing. We specialize in the area of business to business, B2B SaaS, so software as a service. And that's just, it's not a requirement, but we know that we work best with those kinds of businesses because that's our own specialty. That's our mentor specialty. that's where we know that we can give the most pertinent advice and have the most connections in those areas. So when it comes to applications, we do like to see, we do know that B2B SaaS are the kind of people that would fit best in the TinySeed ecosystem. So conversely, like marketplaces, there are, yeah, we're open to marketplaces, but when it comes to things like, say, a physical product, there's probably other accelerators, other businesses that are probably better for them. But all these kind of things, I'm not going to say they're ever like a requirement, like we're going to immediately ban the application if we see something that's a product, but it does going to invite some more scrutiny from us, because we do know that the chances of their success with us would be lower just because we don't have a lot of knowledge in that area.
So is it typically like cloud-based services, like web apps and stuff like that?
Yeah. Exactly. So we've deliberately tried to keep everything very narrow. Again, it just works out well for us to keep things narrow, because we can create the content through the year-long program to make sure that people can benefit from that content. We can make sure that people benefit from each other and whatnot. There are other people in our space, like indie.vc, that will invest in a wider range of startups. So usually if someone is coming from another area and they're not sure if TinySeed is best for them, IndieVC is really great as well. So there's other people out there who are investing in this kind of indie space, trying to give bootstrappers more options, give them just enough money, which is really great, because it means that the bootstrapping ecosystem as a whole has a lot of options, a lot of places they can go. And I think a lot of people have a higher chance of success.
So, what's the salary cap again? I wasn't really clear about what the difference was between that and the salary.
So I say if there's a founder in San Francisco who's starting a company and goes into TinySeed. So if the founder's salary cap will be in the TinySeed docs, if I recall correctly, and it's based on the software engineering salary of the closest major city. So that would be, say, San Francisco in this example. So say San Francisco salary, I'm guessing right now, I want to say it's probably like 180,000 per year. So that means that the founder can pay themselves up to 180,000. But if they decide at any point in their company's life cycle that, you know, they're super successful, they want to pay them more, they can pay themselves more beyond the salary cap with dividends. And that's the point when, so say if TinySeed owns 10% of the company and dividends are issued, then TinySeed will get 10% of those dividends issued. So it just kind of, it does limit the amount of money, I guess, that the founders could make. But the nice thing is that it means that TinySeed isn't taking, like some other companies will do profit sharing. So when profit comes out, like say the company has a certain amount of profit, the company who owns 10% will get 10% of those profits. And this way, TinySeed, by not taking profits, we take dividends, means that 100% of the profits can go back into the company until the dividends are issued. So it kind of creates this little bit of complexity, but I think it aligns the interests of the founders and TinySeed in a way that it means that all of us are behind the company as being successful as possible.
Oh yeah, so that is kind of safer than having the profits being reinvested back into.
Yeah, you can hire, you can spend it on marketing, you can spend it on salespeople, whatnot. So you don't have, you always have whatever profits your company makes, you can always reinvest in your company.
So how many companies have you started, how many companies have you invested into?
We have 10 in our first batch.
And that was this year?
We're hoping to, yeah, that started in summer of 2019. It's probably going to go to the summer of 2020. And we're going to have a little bit of overlap with the second batch, which is going to start in spring of 2020. And then from this point on, it should be always spring starts, spring ends for each of the batches. We just started a little bit late for the first one just because we're getting all of our ducks in a row.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically paying like, is that a yearly salary thing or is it like a lump sum? Like
that one, I want to say, that's under some of Rob and Einar. I believe that I can't recall exactly what it is. And I know it changed. So I can't say definitively what it is, if it's a lump sum or if it's in quarterly chunks.
Yeah.
But that if any company went through TinySeed, that's something that's also, I believe, is negotiable in terms of how it works.
So what kind of mentors do you have for these founders?
Yeah, like we have a huge list of mentors, which is really, really awesome. So some of the ones I mentioned before, Rand Fishkin, he used to run SEO Moz, or Moz now. Now he's working on SparkToro. So he's really great with SEO and those kind of things. We have Joanna Weeb, who does a lot with writing and content. Laura Roeder is the founder of Meet Edgar. So she does a lot of stuff with social. Allows you to schedule updates, if I recall correctly, to a lot of social like Twitter and other areas. So she has a big expertise in social and also in just building a company and hiring and whatnot. We just brought on, what was her name? She just wrote a book, April Dunford. She just wrote a book called Obviously Awesome, which is about positioning. So that's something that we talk about a lot in Tiny Seed, is positioning in terms of making sure your content and the people you're going for and everyone, you're positioning your company for the right kind of customers, and all your content is written for that kind of customer, and really trying to find your niche. So we just brought on a mentor who specializes in this sort of area, just because we know that we over the last, say, 8 months have been doing a lot of talk about this. And it was great that we were able to bring on someone. I call them a full-time mentor, even though we're not paying them. All the mentors are volunteers, which is really, really awesome that we have such a great group of people that are willing to help us out. So when I say like full-time mentor, I mean like they're part of our official mentor list, that we have the permission to reach out to them and do intros and schedule calls with them at any moment. Because we have a lot, like Rob Einar and I have a huge amount of connections in the community, but it's, you know, this special tier of mentors. So April Dunford is our last addition into this special tier. So if you go onto tinyseed.com, anyone who's listening to this and want to see the whole list of mentors, I could probably fill up this entire podcast talking about each and every one of them. But there's a full list that's on the / people page. It's a really, really great group of people that that we're really, really lucky to work with.
Do you have any mentors or founders from the UK?
Yeah, we do. And I don't have to remember who they are.
I can leave in the show notes.
Yeah, I don't remember a lot of the locations of people, but I want to say there are people in the UK. I know Moitka, it's not in the UK, so she's Europe. I think she's... I'm going to put my foot in my mouth, I think, if I just start guessing. So I'm not going to do that. But we do have mentors all over the place.
That's cool. That's cool. Mm-hmm. So who are your competitors?
For Tiny Seed?
Yeah.
I guess the two other people that usually are mentioned in the same breath as Tiny Seed are Indie.vc, whom I mentioned earlier, and Earnest Capital. But there's quite a few other that I think that this alternate funding trend has been coming more and more popular. And more companies are looking to do similar things. So I would expect that we would have, quote unquote, more competitors in the next, you know, 2 to 5 years. I think it's going to be a lot more other funds that are launched in this area. So definitely pay attention to it. And I don't really look at them as competitors. Like I said, we can't fund everyone we want to fund. And Tiny Seed, especially since we have such a narrow investment thesis. In general, I want to help more people. Not if they don't want to raise VC money, I want to help people build as a big and as a successful business as they could. And it's a lot easier with money without going into the VC track. And so I am so excited to see that this is becoming such a trend, because it means that there's going to be more money in this ecosystem for more bootstrap businesses to take from. That means there's going to be more potential successes by having just like this initial burst of money to help people go from, say, A to B. And I think that the ecosystem as a whole is going to improve, because venture capital can work for a lot of different companies, but there's been a lot of companies that were started that took VC money that weren't able to succeed in that kind of the VC track roller coaster that they put you on, and have shut down because of that. Whereas they could have continued living, growing. The founders could have built, you know, a sustainable business that kept supporting them had that they not chosen the whole VC route. So I think for especially for online software businesses, the more options for money, the more options for things like this, the more successful everyone is going to be. So I am excited to see that we have competitors, and people we can't fund can be funded by our quote unquote competitors, and that there's going to be more options as the year goes on.
I like this funding model because there's less pressure to just get things yes. done, and then you end up with bad code, and then you're in debt.
Exactly. And, you know, we want to work, Tennessee, we want to work with founders that have families. Our founders generally tend to be older than, say, someone who would go into Y Combinator in the Bay Area. Like, say, we're 30s and up, whereas Y Combinator, I think there's a lot of 20s people in that kind of age range.
What's Y Combinator?
And that's just because Y Combinator is probably the most famous startup accelerator that is more on the VC track of things. So it's in the Bay Area, and they're the ones that kind of like really pioneered this model. Have really been the most successful people who join Y Combinator. It's a 3-month program. They spend that time growing as fast as possible. It's in person. I don't think I ever mentioned that Tennessee is remote. Y Combinator and most accelerator programs are in person. They're usually like a 3-month sprint where you're working nights and weekends trying to build your business as fast as possible. They have a demo day at the end where you get into a room with a bunch of investors, and you have, say, 2 to 10 minutes to pitch your company and try to get as many investors as possible for, say, your seed round or your Series A, and then you just start that fundraising roller coaster. You know, raising your C, raising your A, raising your B, raising your C, trying to get acquired, trying the IPO. So Y Combinator is something that Einar went through Y Combinator. I know a lot of people who went through Y Combinator. It's a really great program. We want to be like, say, the Y Combinator for bootstrap businesses, where we encourage slower growth. We don't encourage that kind of crazy 3-month sprints like Y Combinator does. We want to do a year-long journey together. But we take a lot of inspiration from the Y Combinator program for the amount of like the prestige that people get for going through that program. We would like that to be how Tiny City works as well.
So what advice would you give to a founder that has MVP but they don't have any users in the system, and they're sending emails out, or, you know, trying to get people on the system and just no traction?
Yeah. Like step one is just to find a customer, mm-hmm. you know, and the thing with MVP is hopefully in that MVP process, you narrow down the kind of customer, the kind of person you want to work with, the kind of person that works the best for what you're building. And even if you're just like low traction, you only have 10 or so customers, that's the opportunity you have to work those 10 customers and make sure you're solving those 10 people's their problem. It's kind of nice to be in the beginning stages of building an app because you have a smaller customer set, and it's easier to work one-on-one, talk to people directly, and get the kind of feedback you need in those early stages to really refine your system. And of course, there's a balance there. You have to make sure that the feedback, you're not just implementing all the feedback you get in, but you're just talking to enough people and working on your instincts and figuring out, you know, what's the majority is what people are looking for, and to start building up your company and try to get, you know, just a few more customers until your company reaches product market fit. So, yeah. You know, it's something I find a lot of early stage companies miss is that talking to customers part. You know, it's something I fell into in my first apps as well, where as a developer, I really love to build apps. I really love to build features. Sometimes you being the universal royal, whatever you, can fall in this trap of just feeling like the next step to getting product market fit is just one more feature without talking to customers and without figuring out whether that's something that people actually want, that's something that people are actually going to pay for. So that's the thing I would say is to open up those conversations with customers, be a part of the support, be willing to build things that people want that maybe you're not excited to build. And also track how things are doing. Look at your metrics, look at your churn, look at how much revenue you're pulling in this month versus last month. Be really brutal, like really look at how things are going and use that to inform where you're taking your company. Because sometimes it could just be easy just to build feature after feature, not talk to customers, don't look at how well those features are actually performing, and just get into, this is what I did with Wedding Lovely, absolutely. It's just the point where I just kept throwing things against the wall and never really checked whether they were sticking and how well they were doing. And that was a lot of the reasons why my own app did not grow.
Well, every new feature you add is more expensive than the previous one, pretty much, all things being equal. Because you add more code to the code base, and then it's harder to maintain. So when it comes to transitioning from employment to entrepreneurship, I once asked one of the best coders I ever met, I said, why don't you run a startup, you know, as well as your job, you know? And he goes, because I have a life. So so I like, how does people transition from, say, employment to making a startup? Is it just like, I guess, working the evenings, working the weekends?
Yeah, totally. I think that's one of the reasons why VC funding worked for a lot of people, is that people were able to take just an idea they had, go to some investors, some angel investors, and get some money to help them develop that idea, and use that money to quit their job. And the other unfortunate thing is that, you know, is if you're only working part-time in the company, it's not going to grow as fast as if you're working full-time.
Right, yeah.
And that's another thing that I had with Wedding Lovely, is there's points in running Wedding Lovely where I was like, oh, I'm tired of working on this. I'm just going to go work on part-time. But the business, quote unquote, runs itself. I would tell myself that it just runs itself. It doesn't need to be there full-time. But absolutely did not grow as fast because I wasn't looking at, you know, I didn't have the time to spend on marketing. I didn't have the time to spend on events and promotions and sales and stuff like that. So, I mean, I guess what I'm going to say is I have a lot of empathy for people in that position. That's a lot of that's the reason why we're working on Tiny C, because we want to give people an option to, again, not have to go through venture capital. They can work on something nights and weekends, get some sort of proof of market, and then hopefully have a tiny seed or one of our competitors give them just enough money that then they can move full time without a lot of risk. So I think in general, without options like us, you just have to wait to a certain moment when you have enough revenue to kind of make that leap. But hopefully in the, say, you know, next 5 or so years, there's going to be a lot of options out there for, I guess there's grants too. There's grants, there's loans for small businesses. There's other things that exist out there. And hopefully more tiny seed like services that help people to make that leap without having to do, you know, something drastic or leave them without any revenue or a place, you know, unable to pay their rent.
Mm-hmm. So when you say business to business, I guess that would fall under the category of an app that, say, a private individual could use to make some product, and then it could be flexible enough that a business could use it as a user, but then for like a company kind of deal.
Yeah, like Slack, Skype, those are all like, say, B2B things where like individuals can use it, but really it's kind of like business to business, those kind of things. Whereas like a consumer app would be more something more on the side of Twitter, where your main category of people you're working with are consumers, individuals, rather than businesses. One of the reasons why this makes it harder is that consumers naturally have a much smaller budget than a business. So, you know, with like Slack, there was a free tier for individuals, but Slack makes the vast majority of their money from their business business plans. So if you're building a consumer app, you don't have that that pricing tier for businesses that allow you to make a lot more money from just fewer amount of customers. So that's where consumer businesses can be a lot harder than a business that you can sell to other businesses, a software that you can sell to other businesses. And that's one of the things we kind of look at in Tiny Seed. With a consumer business, you do need some element of virality, and virality is really, really hard to manufacture.
Yeah.
So if you look at, say, you know, like on Twitter, and for in some way, Slack. Slack is supposed to work, but definitely Twitter. There is this amount of virality there that allowed Twitter to grow. But a lot of it was because Twitter wasn't charging, and Twitter had to raise money a lot of B2C, a lot of consumer apps, they pretty much have to raise money because in order to reach a lot of consumers, they can't charge for their services. And so they have to go through this process of trying to build the product, get as many customers as possible, and then constantly raise money saying, look, you know, if I have another, you know, $10 million fundraising, I can reach another $100 million or 100 million customers, and I can do this without having any like proof of revenue, because it's going to be a lot harder to get those consumer app users when they're charging for their product. So something like Pinterest, if I recall correctly, Pinterest like raised a lot of money before they even had any way of making revenue, like no advertising, no anything, because it's a lot easier to pitch to investors how big your app could be when you have no data. You know, you can't, you can say, oh, look how much money I could be making. But as soon as, this is what I had with Wedding Lovely as well, as I, one of my other mistakes I did with Wedding Lovely is I tried to raise money after I was already had a product where I was taking money from people. And so instead of saying, oh, look, sky's the limit, I had data. And they're like, well, why isn't this larger? They could like argue with me over how much money I was making and why I was making it and what I was doing. Whereas, I should have fundraised, honestly, on a free app and the sky's the limit type thing. So there's like these weird little like fundraising quirks and things that are really obnoxious with a consumer app. It sucks because I want to build things for people to use. And I really love to do that, but it's really hard to make it go big without VC funding, because you need to have a way of pay yourself. You can't be bringing money in through the app usually. You need to have a way to pay yourself. You need to have a way to hire marketers and salespeople and whatnot. And that's unfortunately for a lot of these indie funding areas, they need more money than what Tiny Seed or our competitors could give. So you pretty much have to do the VC track.
And I guess like in the age of technology, a lot of women that are programmers, they do a wedding and they spend like a year learning about how to make a wedding once. And then they think, wait a minute, I can turn this into a business idea.
Oh yeah, definitely. The vast majority of people who are working in the weddings industry are people who just had a wedding.
Yeah, yeah.
Because people are like, oh, surely it'd be easy for me to build a product in this area because I have all this information in it. But the problem with weddings, the biggest problem with weddings is that any business you build, you are going to have a whole new customer base every single year. If you're going after consumers, if you're going after the people who are, you're getting married, yeah, they could divorce and get married again in like 3 or so years and you have your customer back. But really, your customer base is all going to depart and move on to something else, and you have to rebuild that customer base. And so competing with people who already have a large amount of traction, like Wedding Wire and whatnot, is going to be nigh impossible, especially for a bootstrap app. I got through it by working with businesses. So a lot of Wedding Lovely, I work with wedding venues and photographers and planners and whatnot, because those are the customers that I could keep year over year and continue that revenue coming in. But a lot of people would launch like a photo sharing startup or a wedding website startup and whatnot that are just based on the consumers. And then they would have to hire a huge amount, a huge sales team, and therefore also raise venture funding to pay that sales team, because they have to get those new users year after year. So it's honestly, I went into weddings because I wanted to change the industry, but I would never build an app in weddings myself anymore. It's too hard to work in that area.
Okay. Well, I realize you're coming close to the end of the hour and you've got a meeting. Yeah. And my voice is starting to need to sleep because of this cold. So
no worries.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners, Tracy?
No, I think I promote Tiny Seed pretty well. If anyone's interested in Tiny Seed, we're tinyseed.com. I am the person who responds on Twitter, so feel free to send over a DM anytime. We just closed our applications for batch 2, but batch 3, if you go to tinyseed.com/apply, you can sign up for our email list. You'll get notifications of when batch 3, we're accepting applications for batch 3.
So if I come
otherwise, go ahead.
And you go, sorry.
I was just going to say, otherwise, I'm tracyosborne.com. If you want, and hellowebbooks.com is my book side project.
Cool. Thanks, Tracy. And if I come up with a B2B application, which I was thinking of coming up with, I haven't started development yet, but I was going to start off for a private individuals, but I think I might just go for business to business.
There you go.
But I already
send me an email when you do.
Yeah, I will do. If I get some customers and stuff.
All right, great. Thanks for talking with me.
Okay, Tracy, it was an absolute pleasure, and all the best, and be following your progress on Twitter with Tiny Seed. And thank you, my listener, for another audience today with Letter Mythos, and we'll see you again shortly. Bye-bye.